Hey, good morning. How are you? Did it turn into fall today? Did it happen? It finally? Well, it's gonna be 91 degrees at 3 o'clock, so hold the claps. I've unfollowed everyone in the Midwest on social media. I hate them all. My name's Ryan Gowden, one of the pastors on staff. I don't hate them. We're in the middle of a series called Moments. So if you're brand new and someone invited you, you're right in the middle of something. We've been talking about all aspects of family, so welcome. So glad that you're here. If you're watching online, we're glad you guys are watching online, making this a priority. And so we're gonna be in Genesis 32 in just a few minutes. Now I know that as we enter part four of a series on family, this is gonna reach into all sorts of aspects of your life, not just your immediate family, not just your extended family, but this is really gonna bleed out into like your workplace and your neighborhood and all sorts of things. And you're smart enough and sharp enough to grab some of those things. But I'm going to focus specifically on the context to this morning of parenting the next generation, these kids of ours, however old they are. Some of you got grandkids and great-grandkids. Some of us have got four-year-olds, all right? And so everyone in the room, I hope, will benefit from today. If you're anything like me, as I find Genesis as well, it's pretty easy. If you're anything like me, maybe you have this goal or had this goal as a parent. I'm just trying to have my kids have as little to like unlearn as possible when they get out of my house. My goal as a parent is to teach them as little as I can that they eventually realize that's dysfunctional and I shouldn't be like that when I start my own family. Now, I came from, listen, Mom, if you're watching, I love you, but I came from a pretty dysfunctional family, and I remember things from as early as 4 and 5 years old. 4 and 5 years old. Anyone else have memories from their childhood about 4 or 5 years old? You can remember. Some of you are like, how do you do that? I have crystal clear, like HD images in my brain of things that happened when I was 4 and 5 years old. And some not so great. And some amazing, some great. But now I have a 4-year-old who turns 5 next month. So what does that mean for me? He and his little brother, who's right behind, and his 3-month-old sister, she's got some time. I could keep blowing it. She doesn't know. But he's going to start remembering these things, these moments in his life. He's going to remember things. He's going to be in his 30s, 40s, 50s, 80s, 90s, and he's going to remember things that happened at home in these days. And so for me, there's a bit of tension as we talk about this. There's a little bit of tension because he's not just listening to me. He's starting to listen. Are your kids listening? My kids just aren't really listening. They're listening, nodding, but then what they're actually doing is they're watching more than they're listening. And what my boy's doing is he's actually starting to, in some ways, copy me. He's starting to copy some of the behaviors that I model in front of him. And I'll spare you a long list because we got to get going. We got 20 chapters of scripture to cover this morning, for real. And so we're going to be in 32. We're covering 25 to 45. But I'm realizing my boy, he's starting to do the things that I do. He's watching what I do and he's doing that. So I can't say things like do as I say and not as I do. He's going to do exactly what I do. From the smallest things, like the way that I sit. Like the way that I sit, like we'll lay on the ground sometimes at our house and put a pillow under the head, and I have this quirky thing that I can't explain it. I do this weird thing with my leg. All of a sudden, it's like, there it is again. My leg hovers up into this weird position for hours. And it was just a year ago or so, we looked over and my Griffin was doing the same weird thing. I'm like, oh, he's sitting like me. No, don't do that. That's so weird. And I realized, oh my gosh, I do that because my dad did that. He was so weird, and now I do that. And that's fun and lighthearted, but... And it doesn't stop with sitting. They talk like us, and they use the words we use, right? They learn things. I mean, some of them, they dress like us. My kids all have just closets full of black shirts. That's all they own, right? You do wear that a lot. Yeah. What do? They eat like us. They eat what we put in front of them, so they eat like us. Some of y'all know they compete like us. You got a competitive mom or dad. You got a little competitive toddler you're living vicariously through, huh? They do. They compete like us. They socialize like us. They entertain themselves like us. They treat others the way we treat others, don't they? They watch, and they're little sponges. They spend money the way we spend money. School takes place, not just at school, but y'all know you're homeschooling your kids, right? Like your home, our families become the school in which our kids learn how to be human. They learn what it is to have faith. They learn what it is to have finances. They learn what it is to have friends. They learn what it is, and they do it by watching you. Anyone feeling tension? Anyone feeling a little bit of it's too early for this? Anyone feeling that good? If you're here and that's you, that's fine, that's okay. We're gonna actually dive into a story here, and we're gonna talk about these kids this morning, our kids, the next generation, and you can put this everywhere. Genesis 32, I'm gonna actually summarize 7 chapters. I'm going to summarize it because if we read through it, we would be here until about noon. But I want to summarize it because I think what it's going to do is it's going to create a little bit of tension for us. And then I think it's going to help us to understand that this family that we're about to read about and their drama trumps yours. Now, it's in the Bible. It's in the very, very first book of the Bible. You find this unbelievable drama unfolding. It's just ugly. It's just so ugly, and I want to share it with you because it's going to make you feel better about you, all right? And so as we dive in, Genesis chapter 32, let me set up the story. I want to connect a couple of stories. You got 2 boys that are coming onto the scene in 32, Jacob and Esau. Esau, or Esau, if you want to be just sassy. Esau, Jacob and Esau. And they're born, and they're twins. They don't come out at the same time. It's impossible. So Esau comes out first, and then Jacob. For Esau to be the firstborn in ancient Israel, that actually meant that he was going to get hooked up with what they called the birthright. The birthright, you and I might look at it and call it an inheritance. But they had it set up so that the firstborn child, many of you know this, let me catch the rest of you up. The firstborn child, the first one out of the hopper, the firstborn son, would actually receive at least a 2/3 share of everything mom and dad owned. So coming out first, that's a race you want to win, all right? Here comes Jacob, here comes Esau, and then his little brother Jacob, just a moment later, just like that. Esau came out, this is just fun fact, y'all know this, right? He came out hairy baby. He came out this little fuzzy thing, it says. He was like red and kind of just this little gross creature, and then Jacob came out like shiny, like pretty little baby, automatically already. So you got this like poor little red thing, this little Hasselhoff looking baby, and then you got that. And then they grow up, and he keeps with the trend of, you know, hairy manliness, and he becomes like a skilled hunter. He becomes an outdoorsman. So dad's digging him. Dad and Jacob Isaac, his dad, is really loving Esau because they can go hunting. They love, you know, wild game and all that stuff that I'm not familiar with. And then you got Jacob. He comes out and boy loves to cook. He loves to cook, and so mom and him, Rebecca loves Jacob because they can talk about things and spend time together and snuggle and all these things, right? And he loves to cook, and so the story unfolds. Esau is outside. It's the weirdest story ever, but it happened apparently, and so he's out hunting forever. He comes in famished. He says, I'm famished. He's so hungry. He walks in, and there's, you know, Jacob on Pinterest looking up a recipe for soup, and he walks in, and he sees Jacob, and he puts down the carcass, and he's like, I need you to give me some food. And Jacob's like, no soup for you. You know, he says, no, you can't have any. And you got that. Good. 3 of you. The weirdest exchange takes place. Esau looks at his brother Jacob in the kitchen cooking. He's like, I'm gonna die. Please give me some soup. And so Jacob's like, got a proposal. I'll make you trade. You give me your birthright and I'll give you some of this lentil soup. Like, that's a dumb trade, right? I've told you before, I've made some dumb trades in my day. The Mickey Mantle signed baseball. Mickey Mantle signed baseball for a Frank Thomas autographed picture. Fellas, you're hating me, right? Yeah, traded that one. Oh, they threw in an Emmett Smith autographed picture too. Woohoo! And so, he's so hungry, he looks at Jacob and he says, I don't even care about my birthright. I'm gonna die. I'm so hungry. I'll trade you. And Jacob's like, ah! And he gets this birthright, gives him some soup, throws in a muffin, and it's over. He goes out and hunts and does whatever he does. Years later, Isaac, dad, is like dying. He's losing his eyes. He's losing the ability to feel anything, apparently, because he grabs Esau, his firstborn, my boy. He grabs him and says, hey. Is that what he sounded like? Hey. I'm dying. Go kill me something and come back. cook it up and I'm gonna bless you. This whatever symbolic, super meaningful blessing that he's about to bestow on Esau. Apparently he hasn't heard about the trade that was already made, so he says, go kill something, bring it back, and I will bless you. We're gonna have this moment. It's gonna mean something forever. Rebecca's in the kitchen. She hears Esau, her son, is about to be blessed by his dad, rightly so. She loves Jake so much, she goes and grabs Jacob and says, hey, sweetie, yeah, put down the pots and pans. Yeah, come here. I heard your dad go to your brother and say, go cook me something, come back, I'm gonna bless you. So you go cook him something, throw on like the bearskin rug so you look and feel like your brother, go in there and bring your dad some food, act like you are your brother. Dysfunction! Act like you are your brother and have your dad bless you somehow. So he does. Jacob goes in, this little deviant, closes the laptop, goes out, gets the hairy whatever, puts it on, goes in, tricks Isaac, dupes his dad. Meanwhile, Esau is outside hunting, slaying something, and he tricks his dad, betrays Esau. Esau finds out, says, first you took my birthright, and then you took my blessing. I'm going to kill you, but I'm going to wait until dad dies. I don't want him to have to mourn your death. Jacob isn't a fighter. He's a runner. So as we pick up in the story, he took off. He's like, ah! And he ran out. And he didn't just like go down to like Mesa. He just went forever. He just kept on going. And he's been gone, as we pick up the story, for he's been gone for 20 years. 20 years. All right, there's your 7 chapters. Bam, you did some devotion this morning. All right, let's pray. Just kidding. Well, I love prayer. I'm just saying we're not done. That's all I'm saying. All right, verse 1, 32. You with me? You got it? Say I got it if you got it. You should be there. I like, told you 10 minutes ago. Okay, all right. Jacob also went on his way, and the angels of God met him. Cool. We don't have time to unpack that, but that's a moment. When Jacob saw them, he said, this is the camp of God. So he named that place, say it with me, Mahanaim. Jacob sent messengers ahead of him to his brother Esau. They're about to cross paths. He recognizes, here comes my brother. So he sent messengers ahead of him to his brother in the land of Seir, the country of Edom. He instructed these messengers, here's what you're to say to my lord. My lord? My lord Esau. He's like, I want you to call him that. What do you call me? Your servant. Your servant Jacob says, I've been staying with Laban. I've been over here for a while and have remained there till now. He's got gifts. He says, I've got cattle and donkeys, sheep and goats, male and female servants. Now, I'm sending this message to my lord that I may find favor in your eyes. I'm sending this message to who? My lord. Anyone ever called their brother my lord? You ever looked up at your older brother and been like, you are my lord, I am your servant? No, that takes them. Now I'm the youngest in the fam. That ain't happening. It's never happening. I will come out swinging before I call Derek or Sean my lord, I am your faithful servant. But he comes out and he's like, I got goats, I got donkeys, cattle, there are goats, sheep, and I'm sending all this stuff out. I'm sending it your way. I don't want you to hurt me. Let's keep going. When the messengers returned to Jacob, they said, we went to your brother Esau, and now he's coming to meet you, and 400 men are with him. Dum, 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 right? This is a little scary. This is a little scary. So he gets scared. He hears, what does that sound like? 400 men sounds like what? It sounds like an army. 9 a.m. This is why we use your podcast every single week. You're interactive. I love you. All right. It sounds like an army. So he says, in great fear, it says in great fear, verse 7, in distress, fear and distress, Jacob divided the people who were with him into two groups, and the flocks and herds and camels as well. He thought, if Esau comes and attacks one group, the group that is left may escape. All right, a little bit of strategy, can't blame the guy. He panics, he sees 400 guys, and you're gonna see, I wanna jump into the next story here real fast. You're gonna see he actually lines up the kids in order of his favorite to least favorite. Look at verse 1 of 33. You would do it, right? Jacob looked up and there was Esau. So here he comes, coming with his 400 men. So he divided the children among Leah. He had 2 wives, don't do that. He had divided his children among Leah and Rachel and the 2 female servants. He's digging Rachel. Leah's a little bummed about that. He put the female servants and their children in front. Front, like front. That's where Esau is. Y'all put the girls up front with their kids. Leah and her children were next, and then Rachel, his favorite wife, and Joseph, his favorite son, in the rear. There's little Joe, the favorite. Y'all know about Joseph, right?
he himself went on ahead and bowed down to the ground 7 times as he approached his brother. I don't know what your family drama's like, but we got a scene where two siblings haven't talked for 20 years. They've separated. One has wronged the other supremely. And you got kids involved now. We got families. He started a family. We started a family. I haven't seen you in a couple of decades. I'd imagine you're rolling up with this dusty mob of 400 men that you're angry at me. And you got bad parenting. It lines up the fam, lines up the wives even, and says, all right, this is my fave right here. I love you. Sort of. And here comes trouble. And what does he do? Jacob, I mean, we sing about this guy in our songs. He's in our worship songs. Oh, God of Jacob. This guy lines him up, but then all of a sudden with, Joseph front row watching, he starts bowing down. He's approaching him. He's approaching him slowly, and every time he gets a chance, if Esau's looking or if anyone's looking, he's on his face. He's submitting and humbling himself. We're about to have a fight, right? That's what Joseph's thinking. That's what the wives are thinking. That's what everyone's thinking. It's about to go down right here in the fam. Jerry, it's gonna happen, let's go. And all of a sudden, if I'm Joseph, I'm entertained, I'm 6 or 7 years old, I'm like, woo, this is gonna be fun. Dad, what are you doing? Dad, why are you on the ground? What are you doing? Why are you gonna get down again? Like, if I'm Joseph and I keep watching my dad submit, I might be losing respect. I'm just telling you, my normal nature as a boy watching my dad, I might be losing some respect for my dad. Dads aren't supposed to do that, right? Supposed to paint your face blue, get on a horse, grab a sword, make a speech, let's go. Braveheart reference. It's early. If I was Joseph, I'd be a little upset maybe. I don't know. This is a moment. He's got a front row seat to it. I've had some seats. You had some seats. My dad's name was Dane, and when he was 42 years old, my older brother Derek, not the oldest, but the middle child, pray for him, he came out real short. My brother Sean is 6'5", I'm 6'3", he's 5'5". When he got into high school, he went to Coronado High School in Scottsdale for a little bit before he dropped out. He was there long enough to get people to hate him. And the varsity football team one day was loading up in their cars outside on Continental Street. They were loading up in these trucks and cars, and they were going to go to football practice and go be so cool. And my brother Derek was out there, like, smoking or something, and real skinny punk with a mouth on him. And he might have said something, maybe not. Stories conflict. But all of a sudden, the football team, like these varsity linemen, and the quarterback was there, and a couple other guys, they start mocking Derek, start shouting at Derek. And it progresses to the point where he's running from them, and he's scared, and they're chasing him. Yeah, you can't do it. You're a freshman smoker. You're not outrunning varsity football players, right? And they grab him, and they start shaking him, and they start hurting him, start putting it on him, start teasing him, start spitting on him, start doing all these things to my brother, and he shakes loose again. And I'm kind of surprised he didn't have a knife on him. He always does. But he just got free, and that's not funny. He got free, and he got into our parking lot in this apartment complex, and he got underneath like a low rider. It was so low that he could get under, but they couldn't, and so he was safe. And I know it's the saddest story in the world, right? And still affecting him to this day. He got out after they left, and he came in the apartment, and my dad was home at the time. I don't know why, but he was home at the time. And he watches as Derek walks in, tries to hide the tears, tries to hide that, tries to get into his room, but my dad's not having it. And my dad says, what's wrong? What's wrong? What's wrong? And Derek gets out enough words to explain, like, football, Coronado, hit me, and he's weeping. My dad goes into a different kind of mode, a mode I had not seen before. I'm looking at my dad, and it was enraged, just furious. He had this, like, thing happening in his heart, and he gets up, and I'm watching, like, you all right? And he gets up and he goes to my room, grabs my Louisville Slugger baseball bat that I won in a coloring contest, because I'm good still. I ask my kids if they want to color all the time. Not for them. I love shading. And anyway, I won. And
And he grabs it, and me and Derek are like, y'all play some baseball? And he didn't say a word, and he walks out, and he goes down the walkway, gets into the parking lot, gets into the truck, throws the bat into the truck, throws it, didn't place it. My dad threw the bat. I'm like, that's unsafe. He threw the bat into the back of the truck, peeled out unsafely in the F-150. It was like a 1980 F-150. And he peels out down the street, and I'm like, oh, where's he going? He turns left towards the high school. This is not a good plan. Grown man, 42 years old, a little bit of anger in him, and a baseball bat. The legend goes that my dad walked into the locker room after parking in front of it. Parking lot, locker room, parked here, went inside, opened the door, grown man went into the locker room with the bat and walked into where all the boys were talking about whatever boys talk about in a locker room, and then went, bam! And slammed the bat up against one of the lockers. And then did it again and again and again. And, you know, they scatter all of a sudden, you know. These grown men, you know, he's got a little less grown, a little less bold, a little less strong. And my dad, let me shorten the story for you. He actually shouted, where's Robbie? Where's Robbie? Who's Robbie? Which one of you's Robbie? And every dude's like, right there, grabs Robbie, starts shaking him. You ever touched my son again? He said some other things that were in church, so I'll spare you the deeds. So I glorified that story forever. Look, nobody ever touched Derek again on that campus. Nobody ever messed with Derek again on that campus. And I walked around. When I got there my freshman year, nobody even looked at me funny, because I've got Batman for a dad over here, literally. And so I'm walking around, and what happened for me, though, is that was a moment that I learned some things. I learned for me, this is extra, I learned that's how you respond to conflict. Someone comes at you, you grab a bat. I did. I mean, true story. I gave my life to Christ at 21 years old. Before that, there was a day, it wasn't long after that a guy said some funny things to me. This guy, JJ, said some funny things to me. He's mouthing off. So one night, I drank a 44-ouncer of, like, Natty Ice or something, and beer. And I grabbed that same bat, true story, and I walked 4 miles at about 11:30 at night to his house, and he had this Mustang 5.0, because Vanilla Ice did, sitting outside. And I took that same bat, and I made some changes to his 5.0. Smashed it. I'd seen that before. That's how you respond. Now, that's just my story, and that is a lesson that I am still unlearning. Now, I'm not rolling around at 11:30 at night smashing people with bats, but I watched Daddy do it, and I was inspired by it, and then I realized at 21, there's got to be a better way than bats. And here we got Jacob bowing down. Is this the better way? Is this the better way? Verse 4. Look what happens when he bows down 7 times. It says, Esau ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Esau, with 400 behind him, ran to meet Jacob and embraced him. He threw his arms around his neck, like big old hug, and kissed him. And they just wept. What a moment that Joseph had a front row seat to. A front row seat to watching a man who came with an army. We will later find out that the 400 men that he brought with him were actually to help support Jacob in his journey forward. He brought help instead of warriors with him. It's crazy. And Joseph's right there at 6, 7, 8 years old, and he sees all this unfolding, and I just got to imagine that stuck with him. And you're going to see this guy. You're going to see him. Go to chapter 45. I want to take you there. This is the funniest. I'm going to skip 12 chapters with you. Watch us do this. I want to connect these two stories. I want to take what just happened in his early days, Joseph's early days, this unbelievable, powerful moment, and I want to connect it. So the problem with being daddy's favorite is that there are some people that are not. There are brothers that are not favorite. So you've got dad's favorite, and then you've got all the other bros. And so when he gets into his teen years, and he's starting to recognize that he's dad's favorite. So he starts to talk about it. He starts to recognize, daddy loves me the most. And one day, that, I don't know why he did this, but they made him this really sweet jacket. Y'all know this, right? Some of you heard this, or you've seen the play on Broadway. He's got this like hyper-colored jacket. Everyone else is wearing brown. He's rolling up in yellow and orange and green and blue, whatever. That's expensive, right? He's got this fancy coat, and he's walking around prancing in it, and everybody hates him. He's walking around just gloating a little bit. He's a little arrogant, and everybody's watching him going, I can't stand this kid. I can't stand this kid. And then it gets worse, because one day, he goes to his brothers and he's like, hey, did you guys have any dreams last night? Anyone? Anyone dream anything? Did you dream anything? I did. You want to hear about my dream? You want to hear about my dream? I had this dream. It's crazy. I'll tell you about it. I dreamt that all of you were worshiping me. Isn't that cool? Yeah, you were all bowing down, up and down, up and down, and you were singing to me and loving me and worshiping me. Y'all like my coat? Isn't this nice? Isn't this nice? And they're like, we're going to kill you. We're going to kill you. So they actually literally, they vow to kill him. And so they take him and they throw him in a pit where he's going to just die. And they have, you know, their conscience kicks in and they go, well, we shouldn't kill him. One of them's like, I got an idea. Let's sell him. So they pull him out of the pit, sell him to, it's all in the Bible. They sell their little brother. They sell him into a caravan going who knows where. Y'all have wanted to do this. No one's ever gone through with it. They sell him into a caravan, he goes somewhere forever, and they just go, good. They grab that jacket, they dip it in some blood that they got, and take the jacket home, and they're like, Dad, Joseph died, man, a cougar got him. It wasn't a cougar, I don't think they existed back then, but something killed him, a ferocious animal, and this is nasty story where he gets bought, and he ends up in a house owned by this guy named Potiphar. This is a whole sermon in and of itself, but I'll give you a minute version. He's at this house where he's working, and he's doing such a great job that he's getting promoted and promoted and promoted, and Potiphar is a big wig up in Egypt, and he's loving Joseph. Joseph's doing such an incredible God, and God's got his hand on him still, giving him favor, and so he gets promoted up. But the problem is that Joseph is real good looking. That'll get you into trouble, right? Like, he's one of those guys that you're like, you're obnoxiously handsome, right? And he is, and Potiphar's got a wife who's, you know, they have some marriage struggles, and she keeps seeing Joseph, you know, mopping, and he's just so handsome that she keeps going after him. And Joseph's a stud. He keeps saying, no, get out of here with that. No. She keeps coming after him day by day. Here she comes, pursuing him, trying to tempt him, and he keeps saying no. One day she's like, I'm not having no today. Today is yes. And so today he walks into a room and there she is and she's like, ah. She goes after him and she grabs his clothes and he's like, I can't do this. I'm not sinning against your husband. I'm not sinning against God. I'm out. And he runs. He's good at that. He's running out so much so that she's like got his clothes and she keeps clothes in her hands and she's like, oh. Now he's running half naked outside. She's inside holding his clothes. You got to create a story in that moment. So she goes, rape, rape. That boy tried to rape me. Husband comes home. Potiphar's like, this isn't okay. Throws him back in jail. This guy's doing everything right, man. Everything right. And he's in jail again. He's in a pit again. And he's in that darn pit for 2 years. It's like a Will Smith movie just waiting to happen, isn't it? Pursuit of Happiness. He's in this pit. And all of a sudden, one day he's in this prison, and Pharaoh is having bad dreams at night. And Pharaoh of Egypt, the number one guy, calls on him. He says, will you help me? I've heard you can interpret dreams. Will you interpret this dream for me? And Joseph says, yeah, I'll interpret that dream for you. God gave me this gift. He lets me do that. I could use that help. But he says, yeah, I'll help you out. Pharaoh's so excited about that, that he brings him out of jail, brings him into the house. He moves on up all the way and rises in power to the number two position. When we catch up in chapter 45, Joseph is now in the number two position, up, down, up, down. He is up, number two in Egypt, all the money, the superpower of the world. And Joseph now has worked his way up, been promoted up. He's not a VP. He's got more power than any VP you know. He can do and say anything he wants. He's now in charge. He's got the Scrooge McDuck pile of food that he's in charge of, and the rest of the world has none. Everyone in the surrounding areas is in the middle of what's called a famine. They're in the middle of this scene where nobody's got food, everybody's starving, they're trying to find food, and they hear that Pharaoh has food, so they're going to make a pilgrimage, a journey to go get some food. Who? Who's going to? Jacob is going to send his sons, his remaining sons. He says, go get some food. Go get us some food or we're going to die. Go get some food from who? They don't know that Joseph's still alive. And he's sitting there on top of that pile of food, not literally. And here they come and they walk in. Chapter 45, let's see what happens real quick. It says, as they're sitting there and all the tension, it says, then Joseph could no longer control himself before all his attendants. And he cried out, have everyone leave my presence. So there was no one with Joseph when he made himself known to his brothers. And he wept so loudly, there's weeping again. He wept so loudly that the Egyptians heard him and Pharaoh's household heard about it. Joseph said to his brothers, I am Joseph. Is my father still living? But the brothers were not able to answer him because they were terrified at his presence. Then Joseph said to his brothers, come close to me. Because they're backpedaling, right? Come close to me. And when they had done so, he said, I am your brother Joseph, the one you sold into Egypt. And now you're going to die, no? And now do not be distressed and do not be angry with yourselves for selling me here, because it was to save lives that God sent me on ahead of you. Again, a moment of humility and submission, even terror, is met with grace and mercy. Humility and submission. In this family context, someone who has been so incredibly wronged extends grace and mercy. And I can't help but think that as he had time to think about this, in the story you'll actually see that as they first came, he recognized them, but they didn't recognize him. They didn't know who he was. He's all cleaned up, nice teeth, hair combed. He's looking good. He's way over here. He sees them and knows exactly who they are. He puts them in jail for a little while, and he has a few days to think about, what do I do? Puts them in just this little shelter over here for a little bit. He has a few days to think, what do I do? And I can't imagine that he didn't think about that flashback with Jacob and Esau, his dad and his uncle. He extended grace and mercy because that's what he had been taught. He had been shown this. He had seen this modeled in an unbelievably powerful moment. I don't want to say that's exactly why he did what he did, but I know that that moment had staying power for him, because in a moment that was identical, the wrong, all the hurt, all the pain, there was humility and submission, and then there was grace and mercy in the context of a family. Is that easy? Man, it's hard. That's so hard. But Jacob had done this right, and I think it had marked Joseph. Joseph's dad, Jacob, had done this right. He had humbled himself 7 times in a row in front of his family member, in front of everyone watching. And I just think that created a legacy. I think in the context of this family, you've heard it said like this, like more is caught than taught. More is caught than taught. That means more seen than heard. More is caught than taught. You know this, right? We see this everywhere, every day. You teach people by putting on display what you want them to do. From Little League to the business world to matters of faith, more is caught than taught. You can talk all day, and there's value in this, but it needs to be put on display. You can talk all day, but it needs to be put on display, because our kids, specifically, they learn more by watching than by listening. And this is why we've invented those phrases like, do what I say, but not what I do. What do the kids do? They do exactly what you do. In fact, I was reading the book Revolutionary Parenting, rereading it again. It's a good book, and there's this quote from it that talked about this. It said, 60% of learning that actually affects behavior, 60% of learning that actually affects behavior is based upon watching someone, your kids watching someone they know and trust, doing something significant. 60%. So that's what this means. This is what this means. What we read about and talk about needs to be lived out, or the next generation's having none of this. This next generation's having none of the talk, because talk is cheap and they have great crap detectors. Our kids can smell a lie and they can smell hypocrisy and they want nothing to do with it. I've been working with teenagers for 15 years and they will walk away in a moment if people are saying one thing and doing another. And I'm looking at this moment in this incredibly dramatic family, this incredibly jacked up family, and I'm going, they got this right. They got this right. When it came down to it and the moment came, they put on display a powerful teaching moment. They modeled a better way. You know, who else nailed this? Jesus, clearly. The most brilliant communicator of all time. Everything in red is beautiful in my Bible. It's unbelievable. And then sometimes you get to the black letters and it's a story about what Jesus did. Sometimes he stops teaching. All of a sudden, he's reaching out and embracing people with leprosy. And everyone's looking going, what are you doing? Oh my gosh, get some soap. This is gross. We don't have any soap yet. All of a sudden, there's like these kids that are crowding around and they're climbing on him and hugging him. And these disciples are like, you unruly little rebellion. And Jesus is like, shush. Don't hinder the kids from coming to me. Jesus played with them. Like, as the disciples, these grown, very spiritual men who would tuck in their shirts, I'm sure. These very grown spiritual men are like, get these kids out of here. This is a rabbi. You don't touch him. He's like, I want to play. I just can't imagine that moment for those disciples. Didn't teach him a lot of things that a sermon couldn't. And one day in John 13, it says he washed their feet. He stopped preaching. And he washed those nasty, nasty, disgusting 2,000 years ago, ain't no socks, no shoes, Birkenstocks and dirt. And he washed the Son of God. Didn't say much as he just scrubbed away. I can't even talk about it. But as they watched, that was a moment that we're still talking about 2,000 years later. Because more is caught than taught. You remember these things, and our kids are remembering these things. And I want to applaud you on this. You're here. You're here today. These moments come your way every single day, and you model what is most important on a daily basis. And your kids are watching as you prioritize this as a family. Some of you are on vacation right now, and you're huddled around a laptop. You could be riding a roller coaster, but Dad said, no, we're going to sit and watch church because we can't be there. You're modeling something that your kids are going to remember, that this is important. You're spending money in such a way that your kids are watching and you're modeling in those moments of generosity. And don't think that it's lost on your kids. They're watching and they're going to copy you. They're going to be compelled to copy you when you humble yourself and submit yourself. When people hurt you in your family. When there's factions and divisions in the family. When Thanksgiving's awkward and you're the one that humbles and submits and extends maybe grace and mercy to the people that have hurt you. And your kids are watching. Your kids are watching every morning as you prioritize God's word and you just open it up at the table before everyone else is awake. And you say, this is important, not just at 9 a.m., but every day. Some of these moments we'll create, and that's your homework today, is to go home. Maybe you got a situation, it's a workplace, it's family, but let me talk to families for a moment. Go home and make a plan. Create habits, moments in which you can model. Create moments in which you put on display how important this is because your kids are watching. The next generation's watching. And so much is on the line, and this is the moment. It's never too late to reach for this ideal. This is an ideal. Reach for it. That's what Joel said 2 weeks ago. It's never too late. This is the moment when legacies are born. So in what way do you as a family need to put this on display, this faith of yours? In what way do we need to put this on display for the sake of the next generation? Let me pray for you, and then we'll be done. So, Father, I pray. I thank you for this example that we see. I pray, and I thank you for the example of Jesus. And I pray that we would realize the weight of the choices that we make, and these moments that we create that set our kids up, the next generation up, our friends up, our coworkers up, our family up, for success and for faithfulness. And so I pray that we would be people that would initiate and we would follow the example of Christ as our kids are following our example. Not simply saying what's true, but modeling that truth for them, because they're worth it. I pray in Jesus' name. Amen.